This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Mark is making you look all puzzled and strange. You've got a big gig tonight as well.
Yeah, no, but don't try and change the subject. What are you doing on Monday?
I'm doing Radio 2 on Monday and I'm interviewing Dara O'Brien, which is a good booking. And the great thing about it, I've done all the prep for
it. Yes, you have, yeah.
Already.
Ask him about evolution, that'll go down well.
No, I think that's only when you're here.
Yep.
Lee Murgan.
Just me then.
Here's a good
Can I come off this chair? This is the comedy chair to make you feel fat. I sit on it, right? And it goes down, and then it keeps going down, as if it's saying you're too fat to sit on this chair.
Well, maybe there's a point there.
Yeah, or maybe it's a faulty chair.
Dear Spade and Archer, this is from Hal. As a podcast listener, I rarely get the opportunity to take part in your debates, diatribes and discussions. However, I was inspired to email you by your correspondent last week, who said his feelings about Antichrist were best summed up by an overheard remark from a woman behind him. This set me thinking, have any of your listeners watching Antichrist overheard or been tempted to remark themselves? Well, that certainly brought back a lot of memories. which was running a few months ago. If not, then you've been poorly served by your fans. I'd offered to do it myself, but I didn't enjoy Breaking the Waves or Dogville, so I suspect going along just to say those words.
I actually do like Dogville. It's Breaking the Wind I can't stand, you know. Oh, Miss McNeil, oh, God is testing you.
New reviews coming up for which films?
Well, we're going to start with The Invention of Lying, which in a rare break from tradition, both of us have seen. And we'll be doing a Pandorum, as we said, Dennis Quaid, and we'll be doing the film which is no longer called My Life in Ruins, which the title of which was changed because it seemed to provide a review in and of itself. Nyarvathalos, My Life in Ruins.
So we have many movies to discuss. Also, columnist Roger Clark is here because he has a book out. It's called Story of the Scene, the inside scoop on famous moments in film. Hello, Roger.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
So this is a beautifully put together book, by the way.
Sometimes
you get books, you're thinking, this isn't very appealing. No one's going to buy this. But this is a beautiful format full of all the photographs that you need.
It's a stocking filler.
And a whole... Is that what it is?
It's
you're
a
the
stocking
first
filler.
Person.
A loo book. It's something to put in the loo.
Oh, see, I love that phrase. The loo book is absolutely right. And for books which are broken up into nice, you know, little, it's a two-page section. You sit down 3 or 4 minutes. It's, you know, funny and entertaining.
And this is obviously based on the columns that you do for The Independent.
Indeed.
Just explain the idea behind what you've done here.
For the last 5 years, I've been running a column for The Independent, which is very famous movie scenes and The Godfather or Rosemary's Baby or whatever. And it's just the weird and wonderful stories that are often behind scenes which people think they know but maybe don't know quite as much as they think. I've tried wherever I can to actually go back to the original people to talk, try and get the real deal, although of course sometimes as with The Wicker Man, you'll find that the people involved will actually contradict each other.
But all the time.
And why is that?
Time is a strange thing and does strange things to the mind, and everyone thinks they know what happens, and they don't necessarily.
So give us some of the scenes, the classic scenes that you would include here, which people go, oh, right, that'll be where I'll turn to first.
There's in Godfather, there's the leave the gun, bring the cannoli scene, and that's one, for example, and that's to a certain extent improvised, and there's a story behind the actor who played that role, who gets the cannoli, which is a sort of Sicilian cream pastry thing. He was actually the highest paid actor on the movie but didn't appear in Godfather 2, and that's always been a bit of a mystery. And I explain a little bit as to what happened there. And
what did happen?
He wanted the woman who early in the scene asked him to don't forget the cannoli.
Yes,
came his wife and is a scriptwriter, and he insisted that she came in and write some of the script for Godfather 2, and Coppola wasn't having it, and so he wasn't given the role. And there's all sorts of weird, bizarre ways of explaining the absence of this quite major character in Godfather 2.
And you famously got to the bottom of Nick Cage eating cockroaches.
Yes, I've got two quite good, horrible food eating stories. There's one for Old Boy where he eats a live octopus.
But that is true. He really did, didn't he?
Yeah, and he was a Buddhist. He Choi Min Sik, the gloriously monikered Choi Min Sik, who was a Buddhist, and he had to eat 7 live octopuses. Octopi.
Podi.
Oh, don't start that again.
And he
he's a Buddhist, so he had to pray between each take to apologise to
to make the octopodi feel better.
Exactly.
I'm sure they benefited
from being killed.
Well, hoping they had a better life in the next incarnation, that sort of thing.
But rather than being eaten on screen in Old Boy.
Mark is here, Roger Clark is here. Story of the Sea and the Inside Scoop on famous moments in film. And I said we'd start with Alien. I mean, you do it alphabetically, but it's still one of the great stories. So just explain the scene and explain what you managed to find out here.
Well, it's you've got John Hurt suddenly getting what appears to be almost like a heart attack and just this unexpected eruption out of his chest, and it's one of the most famously gory scenes in the movies. And it's just a question of how that weird little... Was it the face hugger at the early... The
face hugger, yeah.
What's the second stage?
Well, that must be... It's called the worm, isn't it? Or as Giga referred to it, the chicken, apparently.
The chicken.
In early stages, it looked like a chicken.
That's right. When the chicken actually erupts from the sort of second stage of the alien's development, sort of erupts out of him. And also just the discovery that, for example, John Hurt actually replaced an actor who actually had to bow out of the part because of chest pains. So that was sort of little things like that.
Is it true that the rest of the cast had no idea what was going to happen? So the look of horror on everyone's face as it cuts round is genuine?
I think it's not true, is it?
It's a difficult kind of problem because obviously they knew, you know, they'd read
some
the script.
Knew,
they knew what was going to happen. Yeah, the story is it's Veronica Cartwright is the one who got splashed with blood, didn't know that it was coming towards her.
Yeah.
And she's the one who you see, she's either the girl out of Lost in Space or she's the sister of the girl out of Lost in Space. She's the one who you see going, because the thing had come towards
Danny
her.
Danny Dyer's in it,
exactly. Yeah. And then Jason Statham turns up and kills them all.
Okay, so that's Alien. Mark, you pick one.
Well,
look,
there's loads of extraordinary stories in it. I mean, I think the most extraordinary story is the story of the Crow and the death of Brandon Lee, which is, you know, sort of passed into horrible mythology that Brandon Lee, during his death scene in the Crow, actually got shot.
Yeah.
And it's true, right?
It is true. There was the movie was being made on the cheap. They didn't do the proper prep on the gun. Someone had been messing around with it. There was a little bit of fragment of something in the bullet, and it was just this little bit of projectile. It wasn't a real bullet or anything, but it was the blank managed to push out this bit of rubbish in the barrel, and it went straight into Brandon's sort of stomach and lodged by his spine, and he just... bled to death.
But he activated the... I mean, that was the really weird thing about it, is that they didn't realise that it had happened.
No. Because he comes in the room with a bag of groceries and there's a carton of milk, and the special effect written into the script is that it goes through the carton of milk and all this white milk comes out.
Yeah.
And he actually, even though he'd been shot, actually managed to activate the squib, so the milk comes out. And
the other thing is that obviously people say, oh, this is the curse of Bruce Lee, it's the curse of Trials, because actually, in the end, the story has nothing to do with the curse. It is to do with...
As I say quite specifically, cost cutting from by the studio. I mean, they were directly culpable for this. It's got nothing to do with any curse, really. It's just plain old money.
So lots of other scenes, lots of other stories in Story of the Sea, the inside scoop on famous moments in film. Roger, thanks very much indeed for coming in.
Thank you.
Roger Clark, with the first stocking filler suggestion of the year. What a terrible thought. I was in a supermarket. No, not a supermarket. A department store this morning.
Oh, because not a supermarket. Obviously, a department store.
No, I didn't
store.
A supermarket. Well, the supermarket.
Oh, you've been this...
I've done both.
Yeah.
But you haven't let me get to the point, which was they had their Christmas decoration, you know, the section with the Christmas trees and the cards. You're thinking... No, I know it's October, and I know this happens every year, but every year gets more depressing.
Well, 800 books came out this week, and they're all for Christmas, so...
Really?
Let's start it, yeah.
Roger, it's time for you to go. Thanks very much indeed with that thought that Christmas is just around the corner. Roger Clark, thanks very much indeed. Now, let's start the box office top 10. Let's see how far we can get before the travel.
OK. You're not going to get very far, because you know what number 10 is?
Number 10, it's Creation.
The story of evolution and whether or not Darwin killed God.
So, Phil in York, BSc Ecology with Biology, BTCV, Hedge Lane, Certificate Level 1. Dear Annie and Jenny, having just returned from 6 months volunteering in the wilds of Scotland, I don't know what the good doctor's opinion of Creation is, so I found it to be an excellent film with great performances from... Just because you're in the wilds of Scotland, I don't see why that means you don't know what Mark thinks about this film. But anyway, I found it to be an excellent film, a great performance from all three leads. Paul Bettany is excellent as the grief-stricken naturalist, a role he marked himself out to play since Master and Commander. And Jennifer Connelly effectively conveys both the coldness and the warmth in their marriage. Martha West, who plays Annie with such life and intelligence, really helps you invest emotionally in the film, and I think will go far in the future. Anyone hoping to learn about evolution will go away empty-handed as Darwin's theory is relegated to a few overlapping lines of narration.
Well, I like the film very much. I agree with all of that. I think in the end, the film is not about the writing of On the Origin of Species. It is about the act of faith, whether it be in science or religion. And that's why I like it.
Gamer is at 9. He's part two of the Hal Ewing email. He was the guy who was talking about the Antichrist with yes. someone at the back saying...
Can I just say, it's Antichrist. The Antichrist is a different film.
Thank you. He says, you've probably finished your correspondence on Gamer. Well, you're wrong on that, Hal. Whilst I can't disagree with any of the criticisms made of it, it is confused, incoherent and unpleasant.
And rubbish.
There was a mad visual style to it that worked well for a film about the blending of real life and video gaming. It reminded me of one of the odder offerings Alex Cox used to introduce on Movie Drive.
Alex Cox would never have introduced a movie as turgid and boring as Gamer.
And it was still better than Transformers 2.
Well, yeah, but, you know, it's like, so he's getting stung on the nose by a wasp.
Dorian Gray's at 8.
It's not the best Dorian Gray adaptation, and its problems are absolutely epitomised in the CGI painting. That said, it is not without some good things, most notably Colin Firth, who I think is really good in it.
Final Destination at 7.
No, I haven't been, and it's still in the top 10, and I still haven't been, and it looks like I'm going to have to, and I just don't want to.
500 Days of Summer at 6.
James King at Radio 1 thinks it's excellent, one of the best movies of the year, and he laughed all the way through, apparently. I think it's too kooky for its own good, and I think a little bit of kook goes an awfully long way.
The Soloist is at 5.
You know, which I express great reservations about, and the more I think about it, the more the reservations get even greater. It is, in the end, a TV movie of the week with a couple of good performances, a couple of very botched, clunky, dramatised moments, an uncertainty as to whether what it wants to do is grimy street life amongst the derelict down-and-outs of LA, or whether what it wants to be is a story about the triumph of the human spirit coming soon to a television near you. And in the end, it's the indecision that makes it problematic. It's not a terrible film. It's just not a terribly good film. And I continue to be, as I said before, agnostic on the subject of Joe Wright.
District 9's at 4. This from Fred in Sudbury Town. I can't get enough science fiction. I love District 9, but why did the security force feel they could only use the DNA from the mutating officer? Since they used a healthy alien to shoot with the alien weapons, why couldn't they just have simply restrained a prawn in the chair and made him fire the weapons for them?
No, hang on, do that again.
No, sorry. Surrogates at 3.
Okay, can I say I will read that email and I will answer it more thoroughly next week since Simon has moved on.
Well, we have moved on. Surrogates at 3. Well, Nick's here. We've got movies to do.
It's rubbish. It's just very, very average. I mean, it's not rubbish enough that it shouldn't have been properly press shown, but it's just very boringly plodding, you know, turgid. You've seen all this before, done a million times better.
Lee on this email, could you ask Mark to stop banging the table? The vibrations through
really hard to stop banging the table.
The vibrations through my subwoofer is quite strange.
Well, what you could do for the purpose of the programme is you could disconnect your subwoofer.
Number 2 is Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
I really liked it, and I'm a big fan, and the more I think about it, the more I'm going to take the whole family to go and see it, and in 2D, incidentally. And I thought it was really good and really strange and really surreal, and David Lynch for kids. And I don't care what anyone else thinks.
I took...
you went?
I took Dr. Mayo Jr. number 3.
But you went and you took the 3D glasses option, despite the fact that I told you didn't need to.
I had no choice.
Why?
Well, the local cinema offered 3D or nothing.
So you could see it in 3D or no D?
Yes. So I could go and see it or not
go and see it.
So
you saw it in 3D. Did you pay extra?
Of course you paid extra
to see the film in 3D.
You have no choice.
Did you feel that in any way your enjoyment of it was enhanced by seeing it in 3D?
Well, it wasn't pokey 3D. It was immersive 3D, but there wasn't any value particularly.
No.
Even the extraordinarily weird, trippy sequences didn't really benefit from being in 3D.
But... as a flat-screen experience, which you could imagine, because you saw it in 3D, and actually the thing which happens with 3D is after 5 minutes your eyes get used to it and you start seeing it as a flat-screen film anyway. Did you love it?
I enjoyed it very much.
It's great fun, isn't it?
Daniel Mumby, BA Honours History and Politics, University of Warwick, 2009. Very good place to go, very good course. Dear David Lynch and David Cronenberg, my girlfriend and I went to see Cloudy on Tuesday, and we absolutely loved it. I haven't laughed so much at a children's film since Shrek, and the director, Chris Miller, has come on leaps and bounds since messing up the third instalment of that particular franchise. We were surprised how cine-literate the film was in a way that children's films very often aren't. Obviously, the Eraserhead references are there, but we also spotted Return of the Jedi, the ship flying away from the exploding machine, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom with the monkey pulling out the heart of one of the gummy bears, and even Shawshank Redemption. Our hero stands with his hands aloft in a pose of redemption as the rain falls. This is a film best described as brilliantly insane, and is the second film I've seen. It's the second best film I've seen this year after Coraline. The only fly in the ointment, like Coraline, with the flimsy 3D glasses.
Can I just say that, oddly enough, one of the reasons I really like it is that it's not overly packed with cine-literate stuff, and when it is, it's done unobtrusively. It's not like all the stuff which you get in movies which are made for kids but have got, like, Godfather jokes in them for the, you know, for the grown-ups and are completely out of place and done really badly.
And it's Fame at number one.
Well, you know, it's a remake of the original, which has somehow taken the, whatever edge the original had off and turns it into a very, very sub-high school musical experience. I mean, essentially, if you've heard the new theme from Fame, you know, it's the same song but done in a sort of a street style, and it has the same toe-curling sequence in which their enthusiasm for their being at the College of Performing Arts means that they bounce out of the, you know, they all start drumming on the tables,
and they
all start
leg
leaping
warmers.
Around. No, there's no leg warmers. There's a lot of, there's some jewellery, you know, and then, but then they've all got the issues. There's the one bit
I
in
had
which,
leg warmers once.
No, you didn't.
I did, yeah.
Did you have a snood?
No.
I bet you had a snood.
I did, no.
Spandau Ballet reformed.
It's very good.
You could put on your leg warmers and a snood and go and see Spandau Ballet.
Just to explain the point that you didn't get. Mm. The security force, this is Fred again, the security force claimed they needed alien DNA to activate alien weapons.
Alien
this justified their having captured the mutating officer. To use his now alien DNA, why could they not have simply used a captive prawn?
Well, isn't it because they can get the alien officer to do it? Because he's human, but he's got alien DNA, and they can therefore they can get him to do what? Because when they electrically prod him, he pulls the trigger. And
travel
would that
next.
Happen if you did it with a prawn?
Travel next.
Travel now, I'm hoping.
Travel now.
Sorry. All right, so you answer the prawn issue, and then you can do the travel.
Haven't seen District 9.
If you electrocute a prawn, will it pull the trigger on an alien space ray gun?
I haven't seen it. I know it's not really a prawn, so
but
it's a confusing
you,
question.
Just imagine yourself. Say you are electrocuting a prawn. Do you
Electrocuting's
think
it, a difficult term because technically it means killing someone by electric shock.
Okay. If you were administering
an electrical shock to a giant prawn
right.
holding a space ray gun.
Yes.
Would it pull the trigger?
Yes or no?
Is it
yes
tentacle
no.
on the trigger?
Yes or no.
Well, does it...
Yes or no?
Shall I say yes?
I don't know.
No, I'll say no.
Okay. There we go. That's why they have to use the policeman. Thank you very much.
That was the
and
best
thing.
And
now travel.
Oh, yes.
So you'll have seen the posters. It's on buses. It's pretty much everywhere. So that'll make The Invention of Lying, the new Ricky Gervais film, one of the films of the week. You can watch the interview with Ricky online, all the details on the front page of the BBC Radio 5 Live website. Take it away, Mark.
So, in case you don't know, and I'd be astonished if anybody doesn't by now, because there's been an awful lot of press about this, you mentioned Lying, Hollywood directorial debut for Ricky Gervais, although he's co-directing.
Co-directing with someone else who's never done it before.
That's right. So they're both debut. So they've written it together and they've directed together, and Ricky Gervais stars in it, because he's been in Hollywood movies before. He's in Night at the Museum as a cameo. He's got a cameo in the Christopher Guest film, and he's also starred in Ghost Town, which I like very much. So the story is, in an alternate parallel universe, nobody knows how to lie. Everybody just has to tell the truth. It's just what they do all the time. Consequently, there is not only is there no lying, there is no fiction. So our character, who is a sort of a chubby loser, played by Ricky Gervais, which he himself said, what a stretch, works at a filmmaking company who make they can only make factual films because there's no fiction, because nobody can lie. And their thing is, we film somebody telling you about things that happened. And that's what big blockbuster movies are. And he gets given it's the 14th century, isn't it? Which is the century in which nothing happens except the plague. And he writes a screenplay about the plague, and nobody's very interested in it because it's a thing about the plague. And he's on the verge of losing his job. And at this same time, he is attempting to date out of his league with Jennifer Garner, who is a very sort of, you know, genetically attractive, is I think the way that the script describes her, is that he is from an inferior gene pool. So everything going very badly for him, being in the world that he's in, everybody tells the truth all the time. And this is a scene in which Rob Lowe, who also works in the movie company, comes to offer his condolences for Ricky Gervais losing his job in typically truthful fashion.
Mark.
Yeah?
Do you mind if I talk to you for a second?
No.
I heard the news. They're firing you, huh?
Yeah.
That must be hard.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to say goodbye, and I've always hated you.
You've always
hated you?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, a lot of people know it.
What, you told other people you hated me?
Yeah. I even turned some people against you.
Is that why you came over to talk to me, to tell me you hated me?
No, I came to say goodbye to you, and the rest of it just sort of happened on its own.
Came out, yeah, sure.
I always knew that the Black Plague would never work as a movie. You're an awful writer, assigned to an awful century. But I've always been threatened by you. because there's something about you that I don't understand, and I hate things that I don't understand. But you'll always be a loser, and I'll always be more successful than you in nearly every way, and that's just the way it is.
Now, I think Rob Lowe's really funny. I do think Rob Lowe is really funny. I think he does really well in this. I also think that Ricky Gervais is inherently funny. And on the, you know, the thing I did, the laugh test, with whether you get a certain amount of laughs together, it did pass that. I laughed out loud four or five times, and then there was a kind of congregation of titters, which I think something...
Is that the correct collective noun for a titter?
A congregation of titters, yeah.
A congregation of titters?
A gaggle of smirks, congregation of titters, yeah.
Who says?
Well, I do just now.
I'm not sure that's right.
I believe that to be right.
Well,
Simon.
I think I'm just going to check that.
Fine. If somebody wants to offer me a better, you know, collective...
There's a better collective noun for titters.
I'm going to have
is.
A congregation of them for the moment. At the moment, I think three titters adds up to a laugh. Don't you think?
So well, I think, I'm not sure.
I think it was five laughs and seven titters, which I think makes seven and a bit laughs. Which is, you know, which is fine. As far as comedy is concerned, that's absolutely fine. That's doing well.
I think
well.
You need more titters to get a laugh, actually.
What, how many titters make a laugh?
Well, I would have thought eight.
No, because a titter is a proper... It's not like a smirk or a smile. A titter is actually when you're making a...
How
like
many
that.
Smirks in a titter?
No smirks in a titter, because a smirk is not making a noise. A smirk is like that, but a titter is... and a laugh is... a guffaw is... you know, and so, but they add up. But the laugh test just works on a laugh. Okay, so three titters equals. I think I laughed seven and one titters time. Okay, which from my point of view,
in how long?
In the length of the movie,
that's seven
in
and a third.
Film.
Yeah, how many comedy films have you seen recently in which you've actually laughed more than that?
Not a lot, I mean, well, I've not been terribly
cloudy.
Good.
No, cloudy sure. Chance
cloudy,
meatballs,
I laughed at yeah, many times.
Well, there you go. There's 15, the answer.
Exactly. Fine. There we go. Very good answer. Okay. So, but it's what I'm saying is there were things in it that I found funny, and consequently, by the Kermode comedy test, it does pass because there are comedies like this, and one coming up in a moment in which there are no laughs, nul point, Nederlander nul point laughs at all. Okay. So it did. That's the good news. Here's the bad news. Firstly, it is, as the setup suggests, it's a high-concept movie. And you know what a high-concept film is? A high-concept film is in where there is a single idea essentially stretched out over the whole of the movie. So the ultimate high-concept movie is Twins. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito are twins. That's the gag, OK? The whole movie is based on that gag. Here, the high concept is nobody can lie, one person figures out how to lie. And in order for a high concept movie to work, one or two things has to be true. Either the concept has to be very, very high, and you have to get it immediately, and it just sits with you. Or the comedy has to be funny enough that you don't go, hang on, that doesn't quite work. Now, it's interesting that the guy who co-wrote this with Ricky Gervais, who came up with the original idea, says in the press notes that he wrote it after a weekend of watching Twilight Zone. And it does look to me like it's a Twilight Zone episode. It's an idea that if you stretched over 29 minutes would work perfectly well. Nobody lies, only one person can lie. Let's see what they can get away with. Work perfectly well. But when you're stretching that to a feature-length movie, it has to go somewhere else in order to sustain that. Where it then goes to is, in a strangely moving scene, and you probably talked about this with Ricky Gervais anyway, is that there's a scene when his mother is dying, and his mother is terrified of dying, and in order to comfort her, he makes up religion. He says, don't worry, it's not nothing. What there is there's a beautiful, wonderful place where everybody's happy and everyone gets a mansion, and he invents religion. And the film then takes this slight left turn, which is that lying is about the invention of religion, which in itself is an interesting idea. The problem with it is that it's not funny enough at the point that it does that twist. And then as the laughs start to fall away, the high concept starts to somewhat fall down. And the film turns into this strange thing in which it has an idea, it has a thesis, it's not funny enough to get away with doing it just on the strength of it being jokey thing. So it makes you start thinking, hold on, I'm not quite sure that this idea works as well as everyone wants it to. And you end up thinking, yeah, it's a Twilight Zone episode that stretched out over the length of a movie. Point number one. Point number two, it is star-studded in that there are loads of people who want to work with Ricky Gervais, and understandably, I incidentally speak as somebody who had a four-second cameo in Extras. I was fantastic for the whole of the four seconds.
Great.
I was great, apparently, and I was off-screen. I think it was just my voice. And I think he's great. I mean, I admire him hugely. I think he's, you know, I think he's really serious about his comedy. I understand why anybody, if asked if they want to be in a film with him, would say yes. The problem is that when you've got your Ed Nortons, your Philip Seymour Hoffmans, people turning up literally to do one scene, and go, it does start to feel a little bit like a guest list, which is slightly distracting, particularly when you're slightly distracted already by the idea that the high concept isn't quite working in the way that it ought to. Then...
Worse than that, there is a central, in inverted commas, romance between him and the character played by Jennifer Garner, which is completely flat. Now, it's understandably flat because one of the things about the writing is everyone's speaking the truth, therefore there is no unwritten subtext and there's no tension because people are saying exactly what they think. But the other problem is that in the end, Jennifer Garner's character is not that interesting. So rather than becoming a romance that you actually care about, it becomes nothing other than a device. So the further we get into the movie, the more the laughs go down, the more the high concept goes up, the more it becomes device-ridden, and the more it starts to seem like an exercise in doing intelligent comedy rather than something which is actually intelligent comedy. Now, at the very end, the credits, and maybe at the beginning as well, are in the Woody Allen typeface. You must have noticed this as well.
I didn't notice that, no. Well, what is the Woody Allen typeface?
You know, there's a very particular form of lettering that Woody Allen's always used, and if it wasn't exactly that font, but it looked like it to me, the credits were very Woody Allen-esque. And I know that Ricky Gervais is a huge fan of Woody Allen, and I know that when I saw Ghost Town, which, of course, he starred in, I thought, actually, this really is like the Woody Allen early funny ones, like Sleeper. I mean, look at the work that had to be done to make the high concept of Sleeper work. Sleeper, the gag is, he goes into hospital for a small operation, he wakes up hundreds of years in the future in which they've discovered that all health foods are bad for you, eating chocolate and smoking is really, really good for you. But the gag is sustained through slapstick, through musical sequences, through action adventure, through science fiction. I mean, they throw everything in the kitchen sink at the screen so that at no point do you go, hang on, this doesn't work. It's gag-ridden, and Woody Allen would never let more than like 15, 20 seconds go without a really funny gag. And that's not what you get here. So it's not the Woody Allen film that it wants to be. It doesn't have a central romance that sparkles in the way that Woody Allen and Diane Keaton would. Its idea runs out of steam much earlier than the movie runs out of steam. There aren't enough laughs for it to get away with the philosophical conceit that it's trading in, which incidentally I think is an interesting idea. It's not terrible by any means. As I said right at the beginning, I did laugh 7 and a bit times, and I do think he's inherently funny, and I think it's, I'd rather see it than an awful lot of Drek that's around at the moment, but I was disappointed.
We'll talk more on The Invention of Lying, plus the other new releases, Driving Aphrodite and Pandora, maybe The Army of Crime, maybe we just won't get there. If you could electrocute a prawn and the prawn had a ray gun, would you do it?
I get asked this a lot.
Yeah.
A prawn and a ray gun.
If the prawn had a ray gun.
The prawn's got a ray gun.
It's a man-sized prawn holding a ray gun in his prawn hand. If you electrocuted
it's not gonna be a hand, then, is it?
His prawn tentacle. If you electrocuted him, would he pull the trigger?
I guess so, yeah.
There you go.
Reflex action. Prawn reflex action.
Thanks very much for sorting that out. We needed help.
I'm sticking with the no. That's why they need the half.
We can speak
hybrid.
To our prawn correspondent.
I'm sure we've got one somewhere.
Yeah.
Dr. Einstein in Blackpool. Regarding the prawn debate, it would depend if you administered a direct current shock or an alternating current shock. AC would cause you to grip and release, and DC would cause you to grip hard. Does that help?
Well, if you grip the trigger at all, it's a one-off thing, isn't it? I know that's why AC was invented, wasn't it? I'm sure there's other reasons why it was, but the idea is that but also you're always meant to touch
a barrel of titters, a Howard of titters, a Twitter of titters. Your titter chat is dangerously close to kookiness. Simon, get on with it.
Yeah, fine. Yeah, awesome. Actually, but that's it. Okay.
And Fergus, it's a torrent or a cacophony. Also, your audience is all double monikered out, guys. 8 giggles in a chortle, 16 chortles to a guffaw, 12 guffaws to a chuckle, 10 chuckles equals 1 laugh. As they say in Hollywood, says Sheena Hastings in Leeds, you do the math.
Okay. That means I laughed 6 times.
Hello to Stephen Fry, David Morrissey, Michael Sheen, Jason Isaacs.
You've got a list now.
I wrote them down in case I forgot.
Okay.
That's a very sensible thing. Fairport Convention Focus, and all members of Faust, who we hadn't said hello to before, but in the prog rock dictionary under F, they hadn't been mentioned.
Okay. So are we just going through the prog rock dictionary?
Only if it's F.
Okay.
So Fairport Convention and Focus.
And Faust.
And I think that might be it.
Okay.
Dear TS and Brody, this is Jack, saw The Invention of Lying last night. Whilst it was incredibly funny, it had no real moral centre that makes you think how much more the rest of the film... makes you think more about the film's inconsistencies. For example, how can Edward Norton's cop be able to take a bribe if he doesn't know about deceit?
Yeah, you see,
an odd film when the funniest moment involves Barry off EastEnders. Expected better from Mr. Gervais, as he's a true comic genius, but then nobody said he would always deliver a message that comedy with that comedy. That's Jack Gregson. And wouldn't a movie excuse me, headlining Stephen Merchant Barry off EastEnders Be Fantastic. Well, he's working with them on the next film. I would think it is...
You saw it, right? What did you think?
Well, I think you do laugh the requisite number of times. Maybe you laugh slightly more than you. But I think it's more interesting. And then when it stops being funny, you do kind of think, well, that's quite interesting. The signage is funny.
Yes, the signage is funny.
Signage is very funny, but you kind of think, oh, that's quite an interesting. You know, creativity, is that lying? You know, and there's no flattery. That's quite an interesting concept. And I thought it was quite an interesting sort of sit down and talk about it over a glass or two sort of.
Yeah, but that's getting dangerously close to 70s, you know, spag bol. Is there? And, you know, that's... can I just say on the subject of the signage, as an indication of it not being as funny as it should be, when, because you see a sign, there's an advert for Coke which says, drink Coke, it's brown sugary water, and famous, right? And then later on, there's a very funny gag which says, Pepsi, for when they haven't got Coke. But because of the way that the comedy was going, I actually then thought, oh, I wonder whether they legally had to clear that.
I think the ad for Coke is very funny, because at the end it concludes with a guy just tasting it, says, nah,
it's a bit sugary. Yeah, the ad for Coke is, but the fact is that by the time we get to the Pepsi payoff, the laughter has subsided enough that rather than laughing at the gag, I'm wondering about the legal implications of it. And that bothers me. I mean, don't get me wrong. I still think Ricky Gervais is a genius, and I'm sure that there is genius work in him. This just isn't it. It's a steep learning curve.
Jonah, age 15, in Hackney, dear Vickers van der Merwe and the Prawn, I'm really surprised Dr. Kermit didn't notice this huge plot hole in this parallel universe in Ricky's film. It isn't just that people can't tell lies, it's that they are compelled to tell the truth.
Yes.
This somewhat mars the high concept, in my opinion, and is an excuse for comedy which entails people insulting each other. Well, I find it a bit lazy.
There is a weird thing, isn't there, about people telling the truth and actually having to say everything the minute it comes into your head are two slightly different things. But actually the bigger issue is, as the guy said, In a world in which there have been no lies, if you start wondering about this, there's all manner of things which don't work. Of course they don't work. It's a comic conceit. But comic conceits like that, high concept, because it can only work if you're laughing enough to not be bothered. If afterwards you start worrying about it, that's perfectly fine. But during the screening, it means that on a fundamental level, it's not working. And I would say to you that as a perfect example, watch this back-to-back with Sleeper. Sleeper is really a textbook case in how you do this. If you have, you know, you have a single idea that you want to spin out over the course of the movie, you have to work really hard at getting the laughs. And it's funny because Alan does descend into musical slapstick, into action, into... I mean, the scene in which Milo is trying to get out of the space age thing tied to the tape and it's playing the jazz music. I mean, it's a 5-minute, 3-4 minute musical sequence. He's really pulling out all the stops. He's not just relying on the joke itself being funny enough.
The Invention of Lying, it's out today, and you can watch that Ricky Gervais interview online if you wish to on the Five Live website. What else is
Driving
there?
Aphrodite, or My Life in Ruins. And as an example of just how funny The Invention of Lying is, let's stand it up next to Driving Aphrodite, which had, from my experience, no laughs at all. It was originally entitled My Life in Ruins. I think actually in America it was released as that. They changed it presumably because it just looks like a review of the film. Remember Nea Vardalos was in My Big Fat Greek Wedding? Remember that?
I do remember that.
She wrote it originally, I think, as a one-woman stand-up show. Then it was picked up, turned into a movie. It became, I may be wrong, I think it became the biggest money-spending independent movie hit of the time. I think it was then outstripped, obviously, by Passion of the Christ, but it took more money than Blair Witch, or cost less and then took more. So it was a huge, big hit. Ever since then, Nea Vardalos has struggled to kind of find a vehicle that will, you know, give her the same sort of results. And she did that thing, Connie and Carla, in which she plays somebody pretending to be a drag queen, which, you know, wasn't particularly... So what they do, okay, let's safe territory. Let's send her to Greece. And the story is that she is a Greek tourist guide taking around... And she's interested in Greece, and she loves Greece, but the people that she has to tour around Greece are all bozo tourists. And they are all straight off the racial stereotype range. So there's the Australians who are cracking open tin is a Foster's and talking about going to the toilet the whole time. There are the British people who are uptight and snotty. There are the Americans who are loud and brash. There are the Canadians who are like Americans but intelligent. I mean, it is literally like you just went through the Observer Book of Racial Stereotypes. Actually, we should...
Is there one?
Is there what? An observer book of racial stereotypes? Yeah, I think Dara edited it. And before he wrote the book about, you know, there is no such thing as a racial stereotype. I mean, it is incredible. We've got travel. I have more to say on this. Shall I stop before we get to the clip? No. I don't want to be rude again with the... I don't want to
ignore him.
Prawn
carry
issue.
On.
Can I? I've got a clip.
How long are you going to go on?
Well, there's
for?
A clip and then a review. It'll be another 4 minutes.
Yeah, that's fine. You go ahead.
You okay?
Thank you for asking. Yeah, it's okay by me.
Okay.
It's my show.
Okay.
Carry on.
One of the people on the tour...
He'll do what he's told.
...who's described as the Joker. the Joker is Richard Dreyfuss. Here's a clip of Richard Dreyfuss in one of the funnier moments from My Life in Ruins, a.k.a. My Big Thin Greek Wedding.
I'm Irv Gideon, and I've come here to see as many ancient ruins as possible. And judging from your husband, the trip is already a success.
There you are. And indeed, funny.
I'm killing me. How many of you, like me, have come here to fondle as many nude statues as possible?
Half the reason I came.
Jeez, this is comedy. The Greeks invented it.
But apparently forgot it soon afterwards. So, what are the things that are wrong with this movie? Let's romp through it. The first one is, it's apparently the first Hollywood, I'm quoting, the first Hollywood movie to be given permission to film at the Acropolis since Boy on a Dolphin. That would probably explain why it is that so much of the script does read like it was written by the Greek tourist. There's a fantastic bit when they check into a horrible hotel and our heroine rings up the tour organiser and says, I can't believe that in a country that has so many splendid, well-priced hotels, you've managed to put me into a horrible one. How unlike all the other splendid, low-priced hotels that are easily accessible in Greece, OK? Apparently they thought that it would help promote Greek culture. Number two, Nia Vardalos didn't write this, and she really should have done, because she's a far better writer than this script allows her to be. Plus, she's gone from being, you know, a larger woman to being a much smaller woman, to the point they even have to include a joke about the fact that she's too small. But it just looks like what they've done is taken somebody who was interesting and funny and then tried to fit them into some Hollywood mould which they don't fit into. Three, the racial stereotyping isn't funny. It's not that it's racist, it's just that it's not funny. I mean, it's Australians, maybe funny things about them. The fact that they drink, Fosters and talk about going to the toilet isn't one of them. Four, there is a character called Poopy Cacus. Five, he has a brother who has a name that's even worse. Six, Poopy Cacus is clearly based on the Tom Conti character out of Shirley Valentine. And seven, he's no Tom Conti.
But Poopy Cacus is not a bad name to have.
How much mirth and amusement are you getting out of that?
Well, not much.
That's the big joke. He's Greek. Hello. Oh, yes.
But Richard Curtis gives one of his characters a rude name and everyone likes.
Yeah, but that's the whole point, right? It's not just having the rude name. It's the way. Having Kenneth Branagh called... What was he called?
I'm not going to say.
That's right. You can't even say it, can you?
Amongst the most ridiculous things that you've asked me, that's one of them.
That was it. And every time Kenneth Branagh was referred to by that name, I laughed. Every time Poopy Cacus' name came up, didn't laugh at all. Sorry, no laughing, none. Nil point.
You're just making stuff up now. When Dara Brian was in earlier talking about the worst pub in the world, which he said was in Los Angeles, well, Mel Lambert... This is about English-themed pubs.
Yes.
Mel Lambert is in Burbank. I transported Londoners since 1980. I'd like to address the state of blighty bars in my hometown. please don't judge our hostelries from the Sunset Boulevard's Coach and Horses. There are many, many better establishments, including the King and Queen, half a mile east of the offensive watering hole, the King's Head in Santa Monica, plus a number in the valley. I'd be willing to introduce Mark to the delights of cold Watney's during his next visit. But if you go to LA, you go to an American bar.
Yeah, you do.
That's what you do.
I know, you do.
You wouldn't go to a theme bar.
Or, on the other hand, or you go to a diner.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely fine. Now, look, so the invention of lying looks as though it's going heading at the moment. It would seem early days. There was only 8 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
It could be the movie of the week. So
okay.
What else is out there to challenge for this illustrious title?
Pandorum, from the producers of Resident Evil.
Is that the plural of Pandora?
I don't know. I suppose it must be. Yeah.
Anyway,
Dennis Quaid and Ben Foster.
Don't let me put you off.
No, you saw Alien, right? You know, a ship in space, right? People asleep. Computer wakes them up. Strange, they're not expecting to be woken up. Well, that, right? And then, you know that bit in Event Horizon, they get woken up, they're in their pants, they have to kind of, get their...
Always in their pants.
Yeah, that, like that. And then everyone's forgotten what they're doing, like Philip Dick, it's like that. And then there's a bunch of Gribblies running around, like Alien. Here's a clip.
We have to try and contact the bridge.
You're assuming that there is someone on the bridge.
There has to be. We can't be alone in this.
Well, alone or not, we can't assume help will be coming. Out here, there is no rescue and there is no turning around.
I don't think this thing was even built to return.
What are you talking about?
I'm saying that this is no ordinary transport. We're not out on the belt collecting data. We're not hauling cargo.
We are the cargo.
What? If you've seen Dark Star, Fight Club, Alien 3, Android, Life Force, you'll go, yeah, that bit, that bit, that bit, that bit, that bit.
I haven't seen Android Life Force.
No, but you've seen all of this stuff.
What happens in that?
You know, what happens in this, right? Spaceship in space, they wake up, they can't remember anything. There's two of them. They can remember. They crawl around some stuff. There's a bunch of monsters running around. Ooh, what are we going to do? Have to figure out a way.
Does the monster kill them off one by one?
Well, the generator is going to shut down in a certain amount of time. They've managed to make a ship that will travel for 100 years, but the generator's going to switch itself off in how long have we got? I don't know, 30 minutes, fine. So what have we got to do? We've got to go down 3 levels in 30 minutes and then switch it back on again. They didn't build a failsafe into the generator, incidentally. So it's a computer game as well. On the BBFC website, which I love, it says rated 15 for violence, and the violence includes a man being ripped apart by monsters and 3 survivors fighting one of the monsters with swords and knives. Lots of blood, things hacked off, guts, but the poor lighting means that there's no dwelling on the infliction of pain or injury. So I love that phrase, the poor lighting, not the dark, evocative, smoky, poor lighting. And that's about it. It's just poorly lit. It's one of those films in which there's a bunch of bad stuff happening, but you can't see any of it anyway. Because it's just, you know, it's the new aesthetic when, well, you can't see it. Just a bunch of close-up bits that are sort of incredibly sub-Michael Bay and some noise. And then every now and then, people talking in corridors like this. I've got to talk very quietly because there's a gripping hand. Why do we get a, I don't know, are we the ship? Are we the cargo? And then cut.
So, that ridiculous kind of scream. Was that part of the conversation? Was that you?
No, that's what happens. Because
giving up?
No, that wasn't me giving up. No, the sound of me is... And it's, you know, it's very loud and very cutty and very thumpy and very, you know, rah. And everybody, despite the fact they've been out in space for ages and ages, everybody appears to have brought the Vivian Westwood catalogue along so that when they become mutant, they can put on spikes, you know, because obviously you don't want to just be a mutant, a badly dressed mutant. And then it goes on and on. Yeah, you know, spiky things, you know, belt, you know, stuff.
Okay,
fetishy
so when
stuff.
You become a mutant, you wear fetish.
Yeah, you have to. And don't you know nothing? Haven't you seen Mad Max? If you become a mutant, the two things you have to do is wear spikes and get a Mohican. That's it. That's what happens. Literally.
Where does fetish gear come into it?
Well, because, you know, you get spikes, you put fetish gear on, you get a Mohican, and you lose the ability to speak and you get funny teeth. That's how mutation works. Have you not seen any post-apocalypse movies? That's what happens. Everyone, you saw the Neil Marshall movie, you know, when they wall off Scotland and a deadly virus breaks out, the first thing that happens is they start listening to Adam and the Ants, getting Mohicans, wearing spikes. That's how the world's going to end.
Oh, okay.
And it's incredibly boring and really loud and dull, and nothing happens a lot, and lots of shouty nothing and thumpy nothing and blood spurtingy nothing and limb rippingy nothing happens. And what I'm wondering
quite
is
a lot happens.
Yeah, a lot of nothing happens. And what I'm wondering is how can a film in which the BBFC detail includes guts flopping out and all that sort of stuff be that boring? Because, you know, at least if I was just there for the salacious violence, I could quite enjoy that. But I couldn't see any of it. And it's all just
and is that when?
Yeah, that's
the... that hurts. And is that when the Vivian Westwood bit comes in?
Yeah, and then it stops.
How utterly peculiar.
Can I give you the film of the week?
What? With 3 minutes to go, normally you just leave 30 seconds.
Army of Crime, which is a very intelligent film about anti-Nazi resistance in occupied France. In this case, the Army of Crime refers to the title that the resistance were given by the Nazis, this particular resistance led by the Armenian Misak Manouchian, who at one point, it's an interesting film. I mean, it's not a groundbreakingly, fantastically put together film, but it's an important story and it's very well told. At one point, they cite that line when Hitler said, who remembers the Armenians, as a kind of justification for, you know, if you commit a really, really atrocious act, in the end, people will forget, which thankfully turns out not to be true. The interesting thing about the film is it's very complex in its loyalties. There's one very important moment in which
a character says to another character, well, we've managed to carry out the most recent roundup without the use of any Germans whatsoever. So it is about collaboration. It is about resistance. It's about where loyalties lie. It is also, very importantly, I think, about the role of immigrants in defining national characteristics, the incredibly important role that immigrants have to play in the history of countries that now perhaps are wondering about the role of immigration. It's been compared to films like Days of Glory, also Melville's Army of the Shadows, which obviously the title refers to, but it reminded me as well of, I mean, that, remember that Atamegoyan film, Ararat, which is about the Armenian, because you did see Ararat, you saw it with me.
I've forgotten then.
Oh, that's an interesting film as well. But
I've never seen Ararat.
Okay, so here's the thing. What you need
as in Mount Ararat.
Yes, what you need to know about Army of Crime is this.
Not Yasser
Ararat. It's a really well-mounted, intelligent World War II drama telling a story which hasn't been told enough, telling it in a way which is accessible and understandable and has relevance for a modern audience and has something to say to a modern audience despite its historical setting and is never boring or preachy, although the subject matter that it's dealing with is difficult. And I have to say, despite some of the flaws being, I wouldn't say it was remarkably well made, I wouldn't say it's a remarkably played out drama, there was enough substance in it to more than warrant it being movie of the week.
But is it going to be generally available?
Yes.
Is it going to struggle to be able to find
it? I think it will be. Yeah, I think it will be.
Well, I'm surprises.
Well, there we go. Let's make it number one next week.
Okay, so, but for everybody else will be seeing
The Invention of Lying, that's
fine. The Ricky Gervais film.
Yes, well, as I said, there are 7 laughs or 6 if you're doing 10 sniggers to a laugh.
Don't forget the podcast, which will be available very, very shortly. We're back next Friday.
Yes.
And it'll be Phil Williams with you on Monday.
Will it?
Yes. He'll be calling you out at your house.
Okay.
Escorting you through the rest of the week.
Okay. Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.